Thank you, thank you. So, as I said a few moments ago, today we begin our New Year's series. A week later than planned, but it's okay, we're beginning today. And it is on the Book of Joy. This is a book, well, first of all, I know our book club studied this book several months ago. How many of you have read it? Raise your hand if you've read it. Oh, a lot of you, good, okay. Well, for those of you who have not read it, as I said, there are copies in the bookstore if you'd like to purchase one. It is the book that highlights a week when two spiritual leaders, the Dalai Lama and Desmond Tutu, came together with their collaborator, Douglas Abrams, in a week-long dialogue they did lots of things. They had lots of conversations. Their discussions touched on issues facing the world today, like poverty, war, natural disasters, and discord between countries. But the compelling message from their conversations is the power of cultivating joy in ourselves and spreading it to others. So whenever I think of joy, I'm reminded of the Bible verse, one of my favorites, "The joy of the Lord is my strength." Would you say that with me? The joy of the Lord is my strength. Now, I'm also reminded of a dear friend and former colleague of mine, Augustine Pettis. Augustine and I had fairly stressful jobs in staff development in a major school district, and we were always on the go. And she had above her desk this poster, beautifully framed poster, that said, "I let no person or situation take away my joy." And every card that Augustine has ever sent, and she sends lots of cards, every email, every note, she writes on the bottom of it, "Keep the joy, Augustine." That's her signature mantra. And certainly we could say the Dalai Lama and Archbishop Desmond Tutu are models of keeping the joy, even as they survived over 50 years of exile, violence, and oppression. And just a little background about these two men before we start the series, so we kind of all remember who they are. His Holiness, the 14th Dalai Lama, is the spiritual leader of Tibetan Buddhism. He was born in 1935 in a small hamlet in northeastern Tibet to a farming family. At the age of two, he was recognized as the reincarnation of the 13th Dalai Lama. And at age six, he entered the monastery where he studied extensively. I mean, the list of what he studied is amazing. At 15, he assumed political power of Tibet as the 14th Dalai Lama. And that same year, the People's Republic of China invaded Tibet. Now, the Chinese government did not look on the Dalai Lama very favorably, to say the least. They considered him and his whole movement in opposition to communist philosophy. Eventually, he was labeled a traitor and a terrorist for advocating Tibetan self-rule and for inciting rebellion. In 1959, fearing assassination, he led 1,000 other Tibetans to northern India, where they still live in exile. Now, all this time, all these 50-plus years, the Dalai Lama has worked tirelessly, although unsuccessfully, to establish an autonomous Tibetan state within China. He has traveled all over the world promoting kindness and compassion, interfaith understanding, human rights, and world peace. In 1989, the Dalai Lama was awarded the Nobel Peace Prize for his work. Now, Archbishop Desmond Tutu, there he is sometimes called the Arch. It's his nickname. He's a South African Anglican priest, and he was born in 1931. His father was a school principal, and his mother was a domestic servant. After graduating from college, he really wanted to be a doctor, but he couldn't because his parents could not afford the tuition to medical school. That could be one of those divine detours that we've talked about before, because instead he followed in his father's footsteps and became a teacher. However, in 1957, he resigned in protest of government restrictions on education for black children. He studied theology and a few years later was ordained an Anglican priest, eventually becoming Archbishop of Southern Africa. Desmond Tutu became known for his work as an anti-apartheid and human rights advocate. It's really appropriate that we talk about him before Martin Luther King Day because some have called him the modern Martin Luther King. He was appointed in 1994 by Nelson Mandela to chair the Truth and Reconciliation Commission for Racial Justice. And he found a group that was called the Elders. It was a group of global leaders from all over the world who worked together for peace and human rights. He spent a lot of time in the United States. He served as a visiting professor at Emory University, a professor of theology, at Emory University in Atlanta, and at the Episcopal Divinity School in Cambridge, Massachusetts. He was awarded the Presidential Medal of Honor by President Obama in 2009, and the Nobel Peace Prize in 1984. So that's a background about these two spiritual giants. And despite all of their many, many hardships, they come together late in their lives to talk primarily about one subject, the power of joy. Also, despite their theological differences, I mean, just think of it, one a Buddhist and the other an Anglican bishop, they join together with a nice Jewish boy from California, right? To address a compelling question, and the compelling question is, how do we find joy in an ever-changing, often challenging world? They know that it doesn't matter if you are Christian or Buddhist, Jewish, Hindu, or even atheist. If you're a human, you yearn for happiness, and you can find happiness always, even in the midst of life challenges. So after a whole week of exchanging stories, wisdom, and science, sometimes with laughter and sometimes with tears, these two spiritual giants offer 8 pillars of joy, which we will explore today and in the weeks ahead. And so the first 4 pillars are perspective, humility, humor, and acceptance. And these are called pillars of the heart. The final 4 are forgiveness, gratitude, compassion, and generosity, and they are referred to as pillars of the mind. These really are universal spiritual principles, very much aligned, by the way, with the teachings of Jesus Christ. Remember, Jesus taught about the inclusive nature of the kingdom of God, that it wasn't just for a chosen few, it was for everyone. And as we have mentioned many times, Jesus associated with and ministered to those considered social outcasts, the poor, women, children, Samaritans, and lepers. And on that mountain, overlooking the Sea of Galilee, he looked into the eyes of those 12 uneducated, considered to be lowly men, and he said to them, you are the light of the world. And just like His Holiness the Dalai Lama and Desmond Tutu, Jesus lived under the domain of a cruel foreign power. And yet he taught that our lives should be full of joy and thanksgiving. In John 15:11, he says, I have told you this so that my joy may be in you and so that your joy may be complete. And Jesus Christ modeled every single one of the 8 pillars. They are spiritual principles that transcend religious tradition. So the major theme of the Book of Joy, as many of you know have read it, is that true joy is not dependent on outer events. It's all about how we react to those events. In the first chapter, entitled An Invitation to Joy, we read, no dark fate determines the future. We do. Each day and each moment, we are able to create and recreate our lives and the very quality of human life in our planet. Lasting joy is not found in the pursuit of goals and achievements. Joy resides only in the human heart, and that's where we'll always find it. So according to the Dalai Lama, we can do this by developing something he calls mental immunity, meaning we can learn to avoid the toxic, destructive emotions around challenging events and instead we can actually develop positive attitudes toward them. He compares this to having a good physical immune system. I'm not sure you can read this slide, but I'll read it for you. He says, if your health is strong, when viruses come, they will not make you sick. If your overall health is weak, even the tiniest, smallest virus can be dangerous for you. If your mental immunity is sound, then when disturbances come, you may have some distress over them, but you will quickly regroup. You will recover. This is the power we have within. And the first step in developing this mental immunity is found in the first pillar, and it's one we've talked about before, actually. It is called perspective. A healthy perspective is the foundation of joy because the way we see the world is the way we experience the world. In the words of Dalai Lama, and I quote, for every event in life, there are many different angles. When you look at an angle from a wider perspective, your sense of worry and anxiety decreases and you align in greater joy. He himself was able to reframe more positively, his words, his last half century of exile, seeing the calamity of losing his country as an opportunity. Now, this reminds me of one of my former elementary principals, who was really one of my favorite principals. He ended every single faculty meeting by saying, now, you all remember, these kids are not bringing you any problems. They are only bringing you opportunities. Every faculty meeting, he ended with that. So in the Dalai Lama's case, back to the Dalai Lama, he was able to see not only what he lost in his exile, but also what he had gained. He gained wider contacts and new relationships, less formality and more freedom to discover and travel all over the world and learn from others. So he says, if you look from one angle at a problem or situation, you might be saying, how bad, how sad, poor me. But if you look at that same event or tragedy from a different angle, you can see that it might be bringing you new opportunities. A really poignant example of this from the book is told by Edith Eger about visiting two soldiers at a medical center in Fort Bliss, Kansas, both of whom had been in combat and had lost the use of their legs. One was lying on the bed, knotted in a fetal position, decrying his fate. Very understandable from a human perspective. But the other was in a wheelchair, rejoicing that he was alive. And as he was wheeled through the garden, the second soldier said that he realized that now he was closer to the flowers and more able to look into the eyes of small children. Isn't that beautiful? It's just a beautiful perspective. So the pillar of perspective should not be foreign to any of us. It is certainly part of Unity's teaching. We call it principle number 3. We create our life experiences through our way of thinking. Remember, our classic Unity minister, Eric Butterworth, said in many different books, you can't always control what happens to you or around you, but you can always control what happens where? Within you, your attitude about the event, your focus going forward. And in the words of the Dalai Lama's interpreter, Jinpa, while changing our emotions can be really difficult, changing our perspective is actually much easier. It's a part of our mind over which we have more influence. And the way we see the world, the meaning we give to what we witness, changes the way we feel. This calls us to ask, I believe, in the face of any of life's minor aggravations or in major challenges, how can I see this differently? The Dalai Lama and the Archbishop say, this is the first step of a spiritual and neural journey that brings us closer to our natural state of joy. So what these spiritual giants suggest is a wider and larger perspective, stepping into our own minds to get a bigger picture. every challenge and every problem we confront has many contributing factors. The Dalai Lama explained, we must look at any given situation or problem from the front, from the back, from the top, from the bottom, all sides. This allows us to take a more holistic view of reality, and when we do this, our responses will be more constructive. They both say we suffer from what they call perspective myopia. We are nearsighted, in other words. And by that I mean we confront a challenge by only looking at what's right in front of us. It's just human nature. We automatically react with fear or anger, making it difficult for us to step back and see other perspectives and other solutions. The Archbishop says this is a natural human reaction. However, we can learn to see that even in the most limiting circumstances, we have choice and freedom, even if the only freedom is what attitude we will take. So the two pose the compelling questions. How can trauma lead to growth and transformation? And how can a negative event actually become positive? And they suggest that life challenges are simply an invitation for us, maybe an invitation we didn't want, but nonetheless, an invitation for us to see the blessing in the curse and the joy in the sorrow. And many of you know, I'm tell a personal story here, that my dear husband Bob has been undergoing some healing challenges in the past 18 months. After 31 combined chemotherapy and radiation treatments for colon cancer, we were rejoicing. He rang the bell, and we were so happy. And then he was diagnosed with melanoma, and we were right back to Siteman Center. So please don't misunderstand. I would not have chosen that. He would not have chosen that. I would do anything in my power to keep him from going through that. And yet, we really have encountered many blessings in the midst of this challenge. For one thing, we've had so many prayers from all of you, from friends, from families of all faith. He's had cards and notes and little encouraging funny gifts, you know, all sorts of things. And I think one advantage when you go through something awful like this is you realize how much you mean to people. You really do. You know, you think, oh my gosh, I didn't know that person even cared, and you realize that. The other thing is, we have received so many unexpected blessings from his whole treatment process and being at Siteman Center in West County. One day, we were sitting in the outer lobby waiting for him to go in, and I saw a basket on the table, and it was a basket of cards created by second graders in some teacher's classroom, full of misspellings and, you know, cumbersome drawings. They'd use, some of them used Band-Aids for their, you know, to make people out of Band-Aids and all that, and also so full of joy. Oh my goodness, so full of joy. And then later we saw a big basket in the outer lobby of hope stones created by this young woman. Her name is Melissa. She's 13 years old, and her mother is undergoing chemotherapy for breast cancer. And some of them are funny and cute little cartoons. Some of them have affirmations on the back about faith and hope and all of that, and people just really love picking one up, and she keeps the basket full. Some of our support at Siteman has come in the form of four-legged support, and that is these wonderful therapy dogs. This is Bodie and Boswell. Bodie's on the left, Boswell's on the right. This is their happy Halloween picture, okay? And this is Boswell greeting Bob this last week when he had his treatment. So yeah, it's beautiful, and they come like they're there every Wednesday when we're there, these two dogs. And also one week, we were there, and I saw all this food being carted out. It reminded me of some of us here, except there was only one woman carting all this food out to the waiting areas, and she brought a complete dinner, lunch, I guess, for all of the patients, families, and caregivers, set them up in two different areas. It was amazing, and I thanked her, and she said to me, and first of all, I discovered she does it every single month. Every time her husband has treatment, she brings this huge, and I mean, I'm not talking about a sandwich here, it was huge, buffet. And I thanked her, and she said to me, you know, I just hope that this lifts people's spirits a little bit. And that's what it's all about. That's what community is all about. And that's what Reverend Michael Beckwith addresses when he considers, says we should consider, when the yuck shows up in our lives to ask ourselves the following questions. And they are, this was slightly revised from him, but they are his to begin with. How can I find good in this? How can I bring good to this? Second question, what can I learn from this, or how can I grow from it? And third question, how can I use this to be God's love, light, and wisdom on this earth? One of our former prayer chaplains was famous for saying, God is in the muck. She said that all the time. And you know, what did Jacob learn? Surely God was there, and I realized it not. There is no place we can ever be that divine spirit is missing. God doesn't cause our earthly challenges, but perfect divine energy always surrounds us and enfolds us and gives us all the powers of the Christ. Now, some might call this whole teaching and this pillar of perspective, some might call it Pollyanna thinking. But Abrams writes, I do not think anyone could accuse the Dalai Lama or Archbishop Tutu of not seeing the struggles they faced or the horrors in the world with keen and unflinching vision. But what they are reminding us is that what we often think is reality is only a tiny part of the picture. As the Archbishop says, we can look at all the calamities in our world, and then when we look again, we also can see all those who are helping to heal those who have been harmed. And we realize that our limited perspective was not the whole truth. As the Dalai Lama said, sometimes we can even see our own role in a misunderstanding or conflict when we step back and see it clearly. And so this idea of a wider perspective leads us beyond our own self-centeredness to see an event through the feelings of others and needs of others. The Archbishop says when someone cuts him off in traffic, instead of being angry, he wonders if that person is rushing to the hospital because his wife is giving birth or if some loved one is dying. We don't ever know the details of anyone else's story, but we do know that that driver might be stressed or even suffering. And we can lift that person up and say a prayer that he receives everything he needs. And the very fact of not thinking about our own frustration and pain, that very situation does something good for us. It lifts us. Anger gives you ulcers. Prayer gives you peace. So, we're going to end today's lesson with a silver lining thought experiment suggested in this book. This is a practice to help us reframe life challenges and claim goodness and joy. So, I would like to suggest this practice to all of us. Now, I would never use the word homework. That's a nasty word. I would never use that. So, I'm going to call it an SGO. And that stands for Special Growth Opportunity, okay? So here's the assignment. For the next 2 weeks, I'd like all of us to try to think of some past challenges or tragedies that we've encountered. And then I'd like you to look back and think about what good actually came out of each one. No matter how horrific they were, what good came out? And maybe in your journal or on a piece of paper, record the challenges and the good that came from them. I would love it if Ann's class gets a chance to discuss this, and maybe you all can discuss it after service, you know, next week or sometime. So, this whole practice that we're going to engage in helps each of us reflect about the important question, what's your angle? And to see things from that wider angle, that universal God perspective, because if God's in it, good's in it. And this way of seeing leads us to serenity and the strength to confront problems with creativity and compassion rather than with rigidity and reactivity. So taking this broader, higher perspective leads us to new understandings and new insights. Ultimately, joy is not something we learn. It is something we live and something we give to the world. So let's take a moment now to take all this in prayer. And as we do so, let's just affirm the great truth about our God. And for any of you who might be here for the first time, this is printed in your bulletin. Let's say together, ready? There is only one presence and one power in the universe and at work in my life. God, the good, omnipotent, and so it is.